Hi everyone, I'm Kate and this is Carla, your trends expert at Box Clever. Welcome to our new Soapbox podcast series revisiting our cost of living trends report. So today we're going to be talking about sustainability stalemate trend, and this is all about the fact that consumers are deprioritising sustainability in favour of affordability during a cost of living crisis.
And we're really pleased to have Lucy and Dan, who are both research directors at Box Clever. Welcome both of you. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today. Tell us a bit about where you've seen sustainability stalemate play out in the real world.
Well, we noticed in the cost of living report that you guys wrote for us, there's an observation that sustainability kind of happens by default. So it's not necessarily that sustainable behavior in and of itself is always front and center. It's very often that something else is happening first and foremost, and then sustainability happens afterwards. So what we've identified is that for sustainable behavior to stick, it almost needs to be the default option. It needs to be easier to identify or to undertake the sustainable behavior than it would have been to have undertaken the non-sustainable behavior. And we've actually identified, and we've used this in research quite a few times now, a framework that we can use to identify whether any sustainable behavior is going to be successful or not. It's called the EAST model, and it stands for whether something's going to be easy, appealing, social, and timely. And then we can go into each one of those in turn and talk about almost the frameworks for success. So it's something to be easy. So if any behavior that a consumer is going to undertake is going to be inconvenient to them, then they're not likely to do it. So a really nice example that we can think of is if you have to wash out your crisp packets and take them back to the supermarket in order to recycle them, you're probably not going to.
So I'm always amazed to hear that any consumers even do that. Mm. Who is going to wash out a crisp packet and take it back to Tesco? Mm. Mind boggles.
Right. So number one on our framework for success, it needs to be easy. Number two, it needs to be appealing. And certainly, as we saw in the work that you did on the cost of living crisis, is appealing in this context probably means it's got to be not just convenient, but it's got to be cost effective as well. So if consumers are expected to take upon themselves the burden of extra cost in order to do the sustainable activity, they're probably not going to.
And a great example of that recently has been heat pumps. So for a consumer, it's a big outlay. And although there are small government subsidies, it's not enough to nudge consumers into taking that action. So there needs to be other benefits that will actually, you know, attract them to making that huge outlay. Mm-hmm. So I think that's quite a good example of where the government probably didn't use the EAST model.
Definitely.
Very effectively.
Yeah.
And ironically, so the EAST model originally came from the government. So it's their own behavioural change unit that came up with this framework to kind of help identify what sorts of nudges are going to be most successful in getting people to take the sorts of actions that we need them to take. So we've got the E, it's got to be easy. We've got the A, it's got to be appealing or attractive. So now the S is it's got to be social. And what we mean by that is, do you kind of get the sense that people who are like you do that sort of thing? There was a really famous example where a hotel chain was looking to get its guests to reuse their towels, because of course if you're washing towels every day, that's an incredibly non-sustainable activity. So they were trying all of these different communications to encourage their guests to try and reuse their towels for more than a few days at a time. And they had all kinds of ideas of using different statistics and percentage figures and the volume of water that it takes and the electricity that it takes and all these sorts of things. Ultimately, what they found was that a really simple communication around other people who have stayed in your room reuse their towels. Full stop. And it was as simple as that. And the idea that people who are like you do this sort of thing, and therefore you should too, is playing into this idea that it needs to be social. I don't know if you've ever seen when you're driving down the motorway and you see the gantry signs and it says, take your rubbish home, other people do. Mm-hmm. And it's as simple as that. Yep. If you get the sense that people who are like you do this sort of thing, and therefore you should too, then you're much more likely to do it.
It's that herd mentality, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be the one that stands out.
Mm. Yeah. Because obviously, as part of this trend, we've seen that consumers are pushing back more and more because of the cost of living crisis. And therefore, presumably, all of these things that the EAST model stands for become even more important. than they have been previously.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. And then the T, so we've got our easy, we've got our attractive, we've got our social, so the T is it's got to be timely. And this is particularly important when it comes to sustainability, because it's a very easy thing for people to say, yeah, of course I'll behave in that way, of course I'll do the right thing, of course I'll do the sustainable thing. But at the point when the decision gets made, there are all these other factors that are going to come into account. So if you're looking to influence somebody to behave in a sustainable way, you have to be as close to the point of decision-making as possible. So for example, an above-the-line TV campaign, whilst it might raise awareness, isn't actually going to drive behavior because it's far removed from the behavior. Whereas point of sale at fixture on the shelf when somebody's about to make a decision on what product to buy, that's timely, that's in the moment, that's much more likely to get a reaction.
We did a study recently for a leading home and furniture retailer, and it was all about furniture repurposing, and they were really thinking about the key messages that they needed to land, and there were hypotheses internally that obviously the key message is going to be it's sustainable, it's good for the planet, and yes, you know, that was important to consumers, but we did some message testing with customers and it absolutely wasn't the most important message. The most important message was all about convenience, and that was the most attractive message. It was about coming and taking that furniture away so I don't have to do all of that legwork. So it's a really different way of reframing customer benefits, and it's almost not always assuming that the lead benefit will be sustainability. It's all those wraparound benefits that matter as well.
You see that with Vinted as well, with
fact
that I think the lead and driver for Vinted is financial, like people being able to make the money, and then the planet messaging is almost secondary to that.
Absolutely. I mean, I have three sons, and they all heavily use Vinted and Depop, and the reason they do it is primarily to make some cash and to save money. The secondary benefit is it's also quite a cool thing to do, so it's like a bit of a badge.
Yeah, and that's the social.
And the third thing is that it's good for the planet, and obviously that matters to them, but that is not the primary motivation. Yeah. You only have to look at Vinted, and it's in double digit growth at the moment. So, you know, they've really tapped into that, haven't they? Has that been the driving need? So it's like a win-win for the kidults. You know, they look good, they feel good, they've got a bit more cash, and hey, you know, I'm also doing something good for the environment.
Yeah, it's like that being sustainable but by proxy rather than it being front and centre. It's still a feel-good feeling, but it's not the main reason.
You need to be careful because it's always the first thing that people will talk about, and it's the thing that they will say is driving their behavior, but it's usually the secondary or even tertiary reason that's actually driving the behavior. It doesn't work well as a primary message. It works very well as a secondary supporting message as long as you've then nailed the first thing, and usually that's going to be around convenience or cost.
And interesting that Vinted case study, if we think of the East model, it even delivers on easy. Because if you compare Vinted to, say, selling something on, dare I say, eBay, it's so simple, easy, quick. So it does a really great job as well of, you know, just making it straightforward for me. There is another example that I just thought was really quite poignant, and I heard it on Deborah Meaden's podcast. And she's talks to business leaders, but she also talks to consumers about, you know, how sustainability can be made easy for them, you know, and sort of really tap into their needs. And she did an interview with a woman who'd very recently lost her dad. And she spoke about, you know, how it had been quite difficult to find solutions for his funeral. And she talked about her dad and what mattered to him. And it was about being frugal. That was really important. And he would have been horrified to think they were spending, you know, thousands of pounds on an ornate coffin. He was also really caring about the planet and, you know, didn't want to leave a big footprint, you know, and thirdly, he loved nature. So she was looking for solutions that would sort of meet all of those different needs. And she found it. She did a lot of digging and she found these woodland burial services where they also plant a tree in your memory. And it was just a really great story about how she started by thinking about her dad's frugality and finding a solution for that. But then she ended up, you know, finding this solution that also meant, you know, he wasn't going to leave a huge carbon footprint on the planet as well. So it was just a really nice story of how that particular business had looked at all of those needs mm. together and packaged, you know, something up in a really compelling way for her. Mm.
That's really interesting, isn't it? When you think about how... sort of a few years ago, sustainability was always about costing more and having to kind of trade up to these specific green projects. And now we're moving much more back towards it needs to be sustainable, but actually it, part of that can be that it's the cheapest option, it's the best value as well.
Absolutely. We hear a lot from consumers about this sentiment, you know, why should I pay for more more money to be green? You know, why should a vegan sausage cost more than a meat one? You know, so there are lots of examples like that that we hear from consumers. They just don't understand it, and they certainly don't want to pay a premium for being sustainable, particularly not at the moment in a cost of living crisis. So
yeah, and that's where you see the challenge, particularly with electric cars at the moment, because that is something where obviously we've seen the likes of Tesla not performing as well as they hoped. I guess in that particular climate, people rightly saying, I'm not going to spend that amount of money for something that, you know, quite frankly, I don't actually need, and it's for sustainable, you know, goals that actually the government aren't necessarily, you know, kind of tracking against their particular objectives as well. We know that the government currently has put those goals back in terms of banning petrol cars. So consumers are quite rightly saying, well, why should I have to, you know, meet that kind of meet that target myself and pay that money?
That's a really nice example of failing against quite a few of the criteria of the EAST model, because it's not easy. Yeah. You've got to charge your car before you go, and you've got to be fairly confident that you're going to be able to charge it when you're out, or that you're going to be on the motorway and that you're not going to run out of charge. So it's not easy. It's not attractive, because it's the premium that you have to pay is all on you, the consumer, and you don't necessarily get a sense that any of that is being offset by the manufacturers. And it's not social, because it's being pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. So you look around and a lot of your friends aren't doing it. So why should I? So there are a number of reasons why that doesn't necessarily successfully nudge the behaviour in the right direction.
And it's not timely, because the petrol ban has been pushed back as well. Yeah. There we go.
Exactly. There's no urgency.
And it's a really poor example as well, isn't it, of how government haven't put the infrastructure in place. And we hear from consumers all the time that they expect governments, businesses, manufacturers to take the lead and to make it easy. And it's just another example of where, you know, they failed in that respect.
There's a really great meme actually out there on social media about just, I think we were talking about washing out crisp packets before. I think it was when one of the footballers went to Saudi Arabia on a private jet. I think it was Neymar. And there was pictures of him getting on his private jet. And so I think the meme was, I'm really glad I washed out that tin of tomatoes to save the environment. And this person is flying to Saudi Arabia on a private jet with like ridiculous amount of emissions. But it just sort of sums up that imbalance, doesn't it?
It makes you think, doesn't it? Well, what's the point? What do my small little behaviour changes and my little initiatives matter?
And again, in the context of this fatigue that consumers are experiencing with not just the cost of living, but everything else that's happening coming out of COVID, poly crisis, it's just adding to that feeling of just, what is the point?
I suppose something we haven't talked about so much yet is the sense of optimism. And it works well when you feel optimistic, and it fails big time when you don't. So if you feel like my efforts are going to be worthwhile and create some sort of good in the future, then you're going to be much more likely to engage with them. If you get that pessimism of, well, I'll wash out my tomato tin and I'll wash out my crisp packet and I'll take it back to Sainsbury's, and yet it doesn't make any difference whatsoever because Neymar's going to get on his private jet and governments on the other side of the world are going to keep like knocking down the rainforests, you get that sense that you're almost pushing against the tide, or there's an inevitable sense of, why am I bothering?
Futile.
Well, yeah, it's futile. Yeah. What's all this for?
A good example of where a business is working with consumers to try and break that sustainability stalemate was an example that I saw by a charity called Hubbub. And this charity is all about working with businesses and organisations to make what might seem on paper like fairly small scale changes, but they're always initiatives that, that consumers can get behind. And they partnered with Just Eat. And there's a huge problem with delivery takeaways that food waste is massive. You know, we eat half of it, chuck the rest in the bin. So they worked with Just Eat to come up with solutions to stop consumers wasting as much. So it's things like, you know, innovative things that you could do with a takeaway to, you know, make a nice meal the next day. And it was also around Just Eat making it very clear on portion sizes so that people could make a better judgment, and even offering some smaller size portions as well. And it was just a great example of a business working with consumers to bring them sort of on board on that journey and coming up with solutions that are quite easy and simple, going back to the Yeast model. Yeah. Just very straightforward and attractive, you know, benefits.
Yeah, really good example of it moving into the optimistic, positive, making, you know, you gain something, you get some value from it as well, rather than it being about you need to take this away, you need to stop doing this. So, yeah.
And we had an example in the report about that from Unilever. I think it was for Hellmann's, wasn't it, with food waste specifically, and how can you use Hellmann's to elevate leftovers. And they ran a social campaign where if you watched that on YouTube, you know, for that amount of time, then you got money off that particular product. So again, it's that incentivizing that and carrying a positive message with it as well.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, that's like the Lush example as well that they've done for absolute years, but you still hear it in research where I think it's like if you buy 5 face masks and you bring all the tubs back, you get a free one, and people don't do it because they particularly feel that strongly about recycling the plastic, but they want to get the free product. So it just...
By default.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well.
Thanks for all your examples so far. The next question that we wanted to ask you was around what have you been hearing in the research world? So whether it's briefs from clients, conversations with clients, even hearing firsthand from consumers through our research, our qualitative and quantitative research.
Well, I guess one thing we've been hearing quite a lot from clients about is bridging the say-do gap. So how do we, as researchers, really unpick that and get underneath the skin? Often what consumers say is not actually, you know, what's always happening. So we're frequently challenged to find, you know, just ways to make sure that our research is based on true behaviours and just not what people feel they should say. And sustainability is definitely a topic that sometimes people, you know, feel perhaps, you know, they need to say the right thing, and it can be quite hard to say, well, you know, I don't do much, or, you know, I don't really think it's going to make any difference, or even I don't believe it's an issue. So we have to find techniques to really get beyond those surface responses. And ethnography is one. So actually going into people's homes, you know, finding out what they do, talking to other family members, interrogating recycling bins, you know, to see actually, well, what are true behaviours in this space, can be a really good method of finding out a bit more deeper insight, really. Other techniques that we use in qualitative research might be setting people challenges without telling them that the subject we're going to talk about sustainability. So we might send them into a supermarket, say, and get them to look at a fixture and see what messages they spot and get them to report back. At this point, they don't know sustainability is a topic that we're going to discuss. And it's fascinating to see, do they actually notice any messages about sustainability? We did a project recently that was looking at pack messages, and we actually saved the client a lot of money because messages weren't being noticed, and they needed to find other ways to get that, you know, message out there. So that's just one example.
It's really pertinent as well in a cost of living crisis, where we've seen myself and Carla looking at reports from not just the UK but around the globe as well about how sustainability has become lower down on a priority list in terms of consumer needs. So that say-do gap, if anything, is potentially getting bigger because of that affordability issue. People still say it's important, though. That's the only thing, because it's a social desirable concept, isn't it?
Yeah.
But we do know that when people put that into like a list of what are those things that I need from a product, it is becoming less, you know, less overpriced.
Yeah, and we have to find ways to allow people permission to talk about things that perhaps aren't always, you know, the social norm or the socially accepted thing. So we need to sort of find channels or forums that allow people to be more open. It could be online communities where people feel they can be more open, or it could be sessions that are just recorded with conversations between friends where they don't feel judged perhaps, and they can just have that open dialogue. We did a fascinating project recently for food manufacturer where we got kids and young adults to talk about what really mattered to them. And we did the same with their parents, their teachers, their grandparents. And we played back the messages and the conversations we'd heard, and we got them to then discuss it. And it really unlocked some fascinating conversations, you know, about what sustainability actually means for different generations and what their expectations are.
One of the other things that we saw in that study actually was that sustainability as a thing, it's not binary. It's not yes, you do it, or no, you don't. It's a lot more nuanced than that. So you need to be able to ensure that when you're asking questions of consumers, you're giving them the space between yes and no to kind of have that gray area of, well, I kind of am, or I am in this area, but not in this area. So we developed something called the behavior change model, which we've used a few times now. In surveys that has these five stages, and it's been psychologically validated. So we start off with pre-contemplation as our first stop on the journey, which is I've never done this and I've got no intention of doing it anytime soon. Thanks very much. And actually, when you give people the freedom to say that, they'll be honest and they'll say, yeah, no, that's where I am. So that's the first stop. The second one is contemplation, which I'm still not doing it, but I'm at least open to the idea. So are you pushing an open door? If you want to give me something that's appealing enough, then I will. So that's the second stage, is pre-contemplation. Then preparation is, I still haven't taken any behavior, but I'm about to. So you've got three stages where nobody's actually done anything yet, but they're just varying degrees of openness to it. Then the fourth stage is action, which I've taken some action towards being sustainable, but only recently. And the fifth stage is maintenance, which is, I've been doing this for a while. So rather than this, like, I'm either sustainable or I'm not, you've actually got these five stages that move you from inaction through to action, but it takes into account the fact that it's almost a psychological shift first. You've got to warm yourself up to the idea of doing it and get motivated to do it before you actually do it. And when you use that as your framework, then it allows consumers to kind of relax into being honest and telling you what they're actually doing, rather than feeling like they have to tell you that they're being sustainable because they think that that's the answer that they expect you to want to hear.
Yeah, it's a very sensitive topic to tread, isn't it? And going back to your point, Lucy, as well, and thinking about what you've just talked about there, Dan, but I remember doing a project for pet food sustainability, and that was quite interesting because obviously, you know, you have to talk about what it means as a human first, in terms of your own habits, before you can even think about the second or like third thing that you're looking after in your life past your kids, which would be your pets. And so it was really interesting to talk quite openly in like a one-on-one depth online situation, rather than groups, where we knew if there was groups it could become quite, you know, there'd be a lot of bias there and social desirability, whereas actually in these depths people were just saying things like, I'm just effing sick of having to do all this stuff, and it doesn't matter. And it was just really like refreshing to hear people saying that, rather than this like, oh yeah, I'm really sustainable.
I mean, the reality is your dog doesn't care if it's sustainable. So there are going to be a whole bunch of other drivers. Like, number one, it's got to taste good, because if your dog doesn't like it, they won't eat it, they'll leave it, and you've wasted money, so you're not going to buy it again. So there are all these other criteria that by default are going to have to come up the pecking order before sustainability in that context.
It's thinking about those tensions, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, we hear a lot as well, don't we, about how confusing it is as well. So we often hear, you know, anecdotal stories about, I just don't know if what I'm doing is even right. I mean, the avocado, there's a theme here, isn't there, of avocados, but that's a good example, isn't it? We think avocados are healthy. We assume it's better than eating loads of processed bacon and sausage. But actually, if you really do your research, they use a lot of air miles. You know, they're not local to us. Yep. So you get this sort of mindset, well, how do I actually know if it's a good thing or not? You know, is it the right thing to do? So there's a tension that exists.
That's quite interesting, actually, because in that same study that we were just talking about, so on that scale where we asked people, are you sustainable? Most people told us that they were sustainable to some degree or other, right? There weren't that many people who were absolutely against it. We then asked this follow-up question, well, what does sustainable actually mean to you? And the variety of answers that were so disparate as to be ridiculous, it gave us this insight that actually sustainability doesn't mean anything. As a word, it doesn't mean anything because it can mean anything. It's a little bit like words like quality and value that we all kind of use these words and assume that we're all saying the same thing at the same time. And that if I say it to you, you understand what I mean and you'll play back to me and I'll understand what you mean. But actually, when you dig into it, sustainability can mean all sorts of things. I've actually got a list. Right. So sustainability can mean anything from recycling more of your household waste, buying less to begin with, reusing products, buying local, reducing food waste, cycling to work, buying an electric car, going vegan or not going vegan, but eating less meat, picking up litter, being kind to animals. All of these things are what people will tell us they think sustainability is. And exactly as Lucy's just said, sometimes those are in direct competition with one another. Yeah. You might undertake one behavior thinking you'll be being sustainable, and somebody else will call you out and saying, actually, that's not sustainable. You should do my thing instead. So you end up with this scenario where nobody actually knows what sustainable is or what they should do about it or whether they're getting the kudos for behaving in the right way.
Okay, so just to sum up what we've been talking about today, how can clients nail this trend? How do they get consumers to move past this stalemate?
I think the most important thing is to just reflect on the fact people do care. It's not that people don't care and that they don't want to do anything. I think it's just they can feel they don't know what's the right thing to do. They don't know if it'll make any difference. So brands, retailers, manufacturers, politicians need to really find a way to make things simple, to be transparent, to make it easy for consumers so they know that what they do, what they focus on, no matter how small, will, you know, make a difference. And I think if they can do that, then they can bring consumers on board. Consumers want to feel we're on a journey with this together. So the brands that can tap into that have more, I think, you know, opportunity for success with it. Otherwise, we'll end up with the Neymar example, where, you know, consumers just feel, well, it's not worth cleaning out that tin of tomatoes, or, you know, it's not worth doing my recycling. And obviously, we don't want that to happen.
Yeah, just to add to that, consumers don't want to feel like the burden of responsibility is all on them, and the big organizations, whether that's government, whether that's brands, whether that's retailers, are not doing their bit. So I think our insight, our view here is that as a brand, you need to go first. You need to demonstrate that you're leading and facilitating ways for consumers to follow and be part of that journey with you. And part and parcel of that is almost to demonstrate that there is cost to you in doing it. So as a retailer or as a brand, you're not just making products, but those products are three times the price and you're expecting consumers to pick that up. Demonstrably show that you as a brand care enough about the issue that you're involved with to take some of that cost upon yourself, and that it matters to you and it's part of your brand DNA and it's part of your values. And that's another thing, it needs to feel authentic. Mm-hmm. You can't just greenwash people with these things, but it needs to be important enough to you that you're taking some of the cost and are then facilitating your consumers to come on that journey with you.
Yeah, great example just to kind of wrap that up would be, you know, someone like Octopus Energy, who are obviously profiting from a situation that a lot of people are in and the cost of living, but they talk about it in terms of investment in, you know, greener energy and better energy for people going forward. So I think it, to your point, Dan, it's about, you know, making sure that investment is at the core of what they're doing rather than just passing that on to consumers
and trying to come up with a cost effective solutions is really important.
Yeah, giving those benefits back to customers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then the final thing I'd say is, just as we talked about, sustainability is too big a concept to try and be sustainable. Don't try. focus on the micro behaviors, focus on the one, two or three things from that list that we were talking about earlier of micro behaviors that are most in line with your values, and do those, and don't try to do everything, because when you try to do everything, you end up doing nothing.
Great. Well, thanks both for coming in and talking to us about sustainability stalemate. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast episode. If you haven't downloaded it already, you can access our cost of living trends report by scanning the QR code on screen.
And if you'd like to speak to either of us or any of our guests about the trends that we've covered in the podcast, then please get in touch by the email address.
And that's everything from us. Thank you for listening.